Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice expands consciousness.
This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. Whether you're traveling across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So recline your chair, look out the window, as we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. The solar wind tonight, 353 kilometers per second. There are three sunspot clusters active today, but massive sunspot cluster 1575 has developed a beta-gamma magnetic field that harbors energy for an M-class solar flare. I guess the scariest thing about it is the odds are low, but if a flare occurs, it will be Earth-directed. We have a lot of news for you tonight here on X Squared Radio, so you might as well get you something cold to drink, because it's going to be a great 3 hours. Our phone lines are open tonight, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. And we're going to have the conference line going tonight, so if you want to duck out and listen to the program on your cell phone, you can do so. You can do it one of two ways. You can either dial 760-569-7676 and then the passcode 192919, or if you have a Droid-style phone, you can just go to xsquaredradio.com. You can click on the Droid app, load it down onto your phone, and one click, and you're in Channel 2 at bbsradio.com listening to X Squared Radio. Before we get started tonight, I want to thank my my sponsor, the Food Investor. Lately, I have taken my own advice, and I've been moving my funds out of the bank. I think those of you that are listening to this program are doing the same thing. Just keep enough money in there to take care of whatever obligations and drafts you have coming out of there, or checks you might have to send, or use your debit card money. But it's wiser to keep the cash in your pocket. You see all the instability with the banks, and you can see that Bernanke sees the handwriting on the wall, and he's artificially pumping $40 to $80 billion a month into the monetary system via the Fed. In other words, it's roll the presses, boys. So that's really the last step before a rapid deflation. So you might want to get your hands on your cash, and also you'll want to invest in some precious metals. I personally invest in silver because it's cheap right now, somewhere around $38 an ounce. We know that J.P. Morgan Stanley is greatly shorting the silver, and we also know that major investors, not me, of course, but Russia and China are soon going to be asking for delivery of their metal, which means the paper bullion is no longer going to be satisfactory. They're going to want delivery of the metal. Unfortunately, J.P. Morgan doesn't have the metal because they never bought it. They just shorted it. So it's a train wreck looking to happen, a big, giant silver train wreck. And you can take advantage of it right now by buying silver. Now, I'm not going to recommend any particular port. I will tell you which one works for me. They're not an affiliate of this program. We don't make any money off any recommendations that we make. But I've done my hunting and my probing, and I found what I think for me is the best place to buy silver, and that's APMEX, APMEX.com. Go there, buy silver bars, silver coins, whatever you feel comfortable doing. Stack it up. Because if silver takes off, as all of the experts say that it will, it could go up between 10 and 50 times. And hard metal in your little lockbox is a nice thing to have your hands on. But if you're not going to invest in cash and you're not going to invest in silver, then we recommend that you invest in food. And you know, on this program, we're going into our eighth year now at bbsradio.com, which is the largest, steadily most popular webcast network in the world. And X Squared Radio is, for all intents and purposes, the number one program on that network. Now, we might not be the most popular every day, but most Sundays we top the charts. And one thing's for sure, if you listen to this program, you're going to learn something. And that's why we do it. I enjoy doing it. I enjoy hearing your comments. I love your emails, your comments on Skype. Believe me, it has helped shape this program over the years. But in that 8 years, we have been searching for a provider of not only emergency food, but also emergency supplies like, oh, radios, waterproof matches, backpacks, etc. The food investor has turned out to be that source. We love their stuff. Their food is absolutely awesome. It'll last for 30 years after you buy it. It's pretty much a set it and forget it survival plan, except you don't have to eat those dry, pasty MRE meals. You can eat something that's really delicious, so that, you know, while you're surviving, you can also enjoy a good meal. Check it out, The Food Investor. Click on the Food Investor banner at x2radio.com or x2-radio.com. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. Lots of our listeners have done it, and I'm getting good comments all around. Also, if you're making plans for this fall, there are three events coming up. One, of course, is the annual Conscious Life Expo, which takes place at the Hilton in Santa Monica. They're pretty close to the beach. That's on the 5th through the 7th of October. I will be there, and many great speakers and artists will be there. It's a affordable, especially if you live in Southern California, or even as far east as Las Vegas. It's a great drive, and it's a great expo. The next is, for those of you in the Midwest and the North and the East, is the Pythagoras Conference. That's coming up October 9th through 11th, the following weekend. And the nice thing about that conference is it's 50 of the world's best speakers in this genre, all kinds coming from all over the world, even royalty coming. And it's affordable. It's in the Midwest, which is very, very rare for a conference of this size, Southern Indiana. So it's within driving distance. You don't need to fly. You don't have to have a passport. I doubt seriously you even have to have a photo ID to get in, but I would make my way to that one. And the last one, if you're in Europe, or close to Holland, is the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. That's November 9th through 11th. So we'll be there talking about electric vehicles. And I'm not going to have one there, but I promise the visuals will be amazing as usual. Again, our phone number tonight, 888-429-5471. So much going on. 42 days until the election. Everything hangs in the balance here, one way or the other. And I would certainly be open-minded to any opinions that you have, as long as they're educated and not totally loaded with religious bias. Lots of changes going on. There are mysterious changes happening in the ocean salt level. And this is a Saltspur NASA expedition story, which is a little strange to hear from NASA. They must be really concerned about something. Over the past 50 years, the salty parts of the oceans have become saltier, and the fresh regions have become fresher. And, you know, I got to tell you that, you know, salt is one of those ions in water that's freely miscible, sodium chloride. And it doesn't like to segregate itself. When you put salt in water, it likes to spread evenly throughout the solution. But the degree of this change is a lot greater than scientists can explain. Not only did they not expect it, they actually doubted their equipment. Researchers are headed out into one particularly salty ocean region in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean. Coincidence of coincidence. That's exactly where we're sailing next summer. That's right. Those of you that have been following the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition, remember, it's on for July of 2013. I spoke to the Expedition Charter Company today, and I know it's Sunday, but this is hot for an Arctic expedition. Our producers are excited. We're excited. The charter company's excited. And we've expanded the ship. Not really. We just have a different ship. Instead of 100 passengers, it can take 124 passengers. So that's pretty nice that we were able to increase the number of people that can go by almost 25%. We are also going to be streaming live during the entire expedition. So if you can't make it, or you get seasick, or you don't like cold weather, or for some reason you don't like 10-story seas in the ocean, you can watch it on your computer by just logging in and streaming live. We're going to try to keep that login at somewhere around $5. So just everybody in the world can afford it. Now, this NASA crew that's going out in the North Atlantic Ocean, they hope to better understand what drives the variation in salinity in the upper ocean. Gee, do you think that fits into the mission of what our expedition is all about? Do you think a 450-foot-long, 74,000-horsepower nuclear-powered icebreaker, the only one in the world of its kind, would be able to reach the source of where this other saltwater is coming into our ocean? Ultimately, NASA hopes research like this will offer insight on the dynamics behind the dramatic changes in the ocean's salt content. You think we should invite them on our ship? No. Many oceanographers have a hunch about what is going on. Climate change, Ray Schmidt, a senior scientist in the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, told journalists during a news conference Wednesday. That's September 5th, a couple of weeks ago. Climate is changing all the time, and some of that change is due to natural variation, Schmidt said. The 50-year trend we are talking about, most of us believe, is really due to the general trend of global warming. Well, I have a disagreement with Mr. Schmidt. I don't think that we're undergoing global warming, but anyone with half a brain and one eye can see that we are undergoing climate change. It doesn't mean that the average temperature is changing that much. In fact, I think it's probably on a cooling trend given the growth of glaciers globally. But the extremes between the very cold winters and the very hot summers are absolutely irrefutable. No decent statistician would argue with that. How many heat records did we have broken just a couple of months ago? Oh, yes, over 6,000 globally. And I reckon in about 2 months we're going to get our first kiss of winter, and I suspect it will set records as the last one did as well. Well, anyway, this matters because the ocean is at the heart of the planet's water cycle. 86% of global evaporation and 78% of global precipitation, that's rain, occur over the ocean, according to NASA, the lead entity behind the project called Salinity Processes in the Upper Ocean Regional Study, also known as SPERS. They always have an acronym for things in NASA. I guess we do too, NIPI. North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. Over the ocean, more evaporation as compared to precipitation translates into saltier water. Meanwhile, in regions where precipitation is favored, water is fresher. Well, that's certainly one explanation. That's quite possible. It could also be that there's a sea vent in which another ocean is feeding into our ocean, and it has a different salinity and a different crystallinity and a different ion content. And it just hits the ocean currents and flows to where you're detecting it with your buoys. By tracking ocean salinity, researchers can better understand the global water cycle. Global warming is expected to intensify it, but current computer models do not predict the amount of change seen over the last 50 years, Schmidt said. Aside from an increase in evaporation caused by warming, such factors as winds can also contribute to changes in salinity. We have a lot of questions about the basic physics we hope to resolve with this cruise, Schmidt said. Maybe we should get Mr. Schmidt to come on our ship, and we'll go about 10 degrees further north than they're planning on going. In addition to instruments attached to the research vessel itself, scientists plan to deploy a variety of drifting, remotely operated, and moored sensors. European researchers are also visiting the site and collecting data. Salinity data is also expected to come from the satellite-borne instrument called Aquarius, launched about a year ago, as well as the global network of Argo floats, which measure temperature and salinity. The research vessel Knorr, that's spelled K-N-O-R-R, departed Woods Hole, Massachusetts, for the Mid-Atlantic Thursday. That was last September 6th. The researchers will spend about 3 weeks deploying their instruments, leaving some behind for when they return. Due to hurricanes Leslie and Michael, the vessel's captain decided to travel quickly to the east and then to the south to miss the worst of the weather on their way to the study site. Next year, next July and August, the North Pole Inner Earth expedition will go much further north. And we're going to be gone for anywhere from 15 to 20 days. Why do I say 15 to 20? Because we're chartering the ship for 15 days, but we're also optioning the ship for 5 additional days. Why are we doing that? I'm glad you asked. Because it's going to take a while to cover the 10,000 square miles or so that we're going to survey during our expedition. What if, and the board has thought about this very carefully, what if we get up there and we discover something really exciting, if you know what I mean, and the next day we're due to travel back to Murmansk, Russia? Well, in that case, we just kick in the old 5-day option and we stay another 5 days. That means those of you that buy a pay-per-view ticket we'll be able to view the expedition for the entire 20 days. 15 days as part of the package for around $5. And if we extend due to the option, you get the extra 5 days for free. Now, this is like the best pay-per-view reality program you're ever going to see. 24 hours a day for 15 days. It makes Deadliest Catch look like Gilligan's Island. So we realize we can't take the entire world, of especially the 6,000 applicants that have applied for 124 spots, but we can show you what it's like on camera, live, 24 hours a day. I think it's worth it, don't you? If you're excited about it, if you're thinking about it, if you've had dreams about it, if you really want to participate in this, in directly or indirectly, would you give us a call at 888-429-5471? Because I just think this is about the most amazing, exciting project I've ever participated in. And we want you to participate as well. Anyway, Spurs is named because Spurs come in pairs, said Eric Lindstrom, a physical oceanography program scientist. Say that 3 times really fast for me. Yeah, see, it's not that easy. You should try it. Anyway, at NASA headquarters, explaining that researchers hope to do something similar in low salinity regions, such as the Bay of Bengal or an area south of Hawaii. Oh, yeah, I want that duty. Yeah, give me that duty. And by the way, we'll send out all kinds of headline data on this. As soon as we finish inking things with the production company, which should be this week, we will put up the pay-per-view reservations. You'll be able to get all that going. You don't have to pay your $5 now. Of course not. We know you're out there, all 40 million of you. But we'll have some way for you to pre-register for that so that it's easy for you to make one click. You can just save it on your desktop. And when we get ready to do the live broadcast, you're in. So simple. We're going to make it so easy for you. We're even going to create phone apps for it. So if you want to click on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition app, you just click on it during the expedition, and you can watch what's going on the ship or listen in to what's going on the ship live. And we're really going to make sure that as many of you as want to can go with us. That's what it's all about. So while researchers think global climate change may be behind the changes in ocean salinity, changes like these are expected to have their own implications for climate. And honestly, it's because, you know, the Earth is mostly covered by the ocean. And when we're talking about albedo, which is the amount of energy that any planet reflects back into space, it's measured in terms of percentage, but we call it albedo. For instance, the side of the moon that faces us has an albedo of 10. That means that it reflects about 10% of its energy from the sun back out into space. The other side of the moon, artists typically call the dark side of the moon, isn't really dark at all. In fact, it's quite bright. It has an albedo of 60, which means it reflects about 60% of the sunlight that hits the far side of the moon back out into space. If that's the side of the moon that faced us, we'd have to wear sunglasses during a full moon. But the sea has a pretty constant albedo. It doesn't change color much. It does absorb infrared energy based on its salinity, but it doesn't reflect much energy back out into space. We really rely on snowfall for that, or cloud cover. Because if we have a lot of cloud cover, what happens is the radiation from the sun comes through the clouds a little bit shaded, strikes the surface, but instead of reflecting back out into space, it's insulated, sort of like having a blanket over it. And the more active the sun is, the more cosmic radiation is our cosmic rays in our upper atmosphere form, which form high altitude clouds, a kind of mild shading effect, which can actually result in warming the planet. That's why when we have an active sun with respect to CMEs and high particle-laden solar winds, we have a tendency to warm as a planet. In fact, all the planets in the solar system do this. However, when we have a lot of snowfall, which also results from having this high cloud cover, by the way, because the water evaporates up into the atmosphere, forms clouds, and it rains or snows back down on the ground, then the snow-laden ground or the glaciers or the ice caps tend to reflect energy back out into space. Of course, the closer to the equator that this snowfall hits the ground and stays, the more energy it reflects back out into space for obvious reasons. Now, a couple of years ago, I remember flying from Phoenix all the way up to Washington State. And in my flight from, from the east, from Charlotte over to Phoenix and from Phoenix all the way up to Washington, I was amazed because about 80% of the country was covered in snow. And this was for several days. In fact, when I was flying north along the mountain ranges, I noticed that all of the valleys were green, a very, very rare sight. All of the mountains were covered with snow, also a very rare sight. And every single lake that I could see from 39,000 feet was filled with water. Lots and lots of change in that part of the country. Well, the same thing happens with this variation in salinity in the ocean. It really affects the amount of warmth or heat that's retained by the water. Here's how it works. Compared with fresh water, salty water is heavier because it has sodium chloride in it. You know, chlorine is molecular weight 32, and it exists as Cl2, so it can even be heavier than that. But just the chlorine ions are pretty darn heavy, more heavy than just H2O, which is about 18 molecular weight. So it's more prone to sinking. The salt water tends to go to the bottom unless it's agitated. Temperature also has a similar effect. It forms thermoclines in the water, with warmth causing water to rise. And, of course, the icy water sinks to the bottom. Any of you that have ever been snorkeling know what I'm talking about, either in a lake or in the ocean. You get down to about 20 feet, it's a very noticeable shift in temperature. When you get down about 400 feet, it's pretty darn icy. Differences in salinity and temperature drive a slow-moving conveyor belt of ocean currents that encircle the planet. Here in the United States, off the East Coast, we have the Gulf Stream, which carries warm water across the Atlantic to Europe. It's part of this conveyor belt. It's why Western Europe, like Ireland and Scotland, get terrible snow poundings from the sea. It's because of that warm water that is going over there. It evaporates up, forms the clouds, and they just get hammered sometimes. Same with Alaska. It may work out that higher salinity in some regions counterbalances fresher water in others, Schmidt said. It is a delicate balance, and what we think now is that it's not too likely the conveyor belt is going to shut down anytime soon. So all of you that have heard the rumors that the Gulf Stream stopped, they're just rumors. It never happened. There are buoys all over that Gulf Stream, and believe me, they monitor this very closely, deep and at the surface, because these are moored buoys. That is to say, they're attached to the ocean floor. They stay put. And they're also very good at detecting tsunamis and rogue waves. So that's how we keep track of that stuff. When these resonation waves set up in the sea and create these rogue waves, we know they're coming long before a ship reports in at mayday. That also helps the ships turn their bow into the wave instead of being broadsided by these waves. So this is what we've got. We've got now a new discovery. I know it seems so strange. Here we are in the 21st century and we're still learning things about our ocean. Doesn't that seem strange to you? Doesn't it seem, unbelievable to you that no one has ever sailed where we're going to sail next summer? I mean, it does to me. I have people tell me, oh, you're the hollow earth guy. You're crazy. You're a crackpot. Anybody that believes the earth is hollow is, well, you just fill in the blank. And I very calmly with a straight face respond, wait a minute. Are you a scientist or are you not? Are you a scientist or are you a high priest? I cannot believe that a scientist would say that exploration is a crackpot. To go and see for oneself instead of relying on a textbook that was written by a guy who talked to a guy who heard from a guy who read from a legend what is happening up in the Arctic area. They've never been there. No one has ever been there except the military, and I doubt they're writing textbooks, don't you? You want to discuss it? 888-429-5471. I just think it's amazing. Sort of like UFOs. I have a lot of astronomy buddies who say when we go on dark sky events, okay, Brooks, we're not going to talk about UFOs tonight, all right? No looking up there and say, hey, does that look like a ship to you? None of that stuff. And I always say, guys, don't tell me you're one of the ones that believe we're alone in the universe. Some grapefruit juice. Hold on. I think the adamance towards saying that we're alone in the universe is more like a prove-it-to-me bravado. Sort of like beating your chest and saying, I'm the strongest man in the world, and anybody that's brave enough to step in the ring with me, well, and then nobody does, and so they're still the strongest man in the world. I always say odor isn't everything. Come on, guys. So, did you know that coming down to Earth is tough? Oh, it is. NASA getting involved in this is just amazing. Speaking of astronauts, their experience has shown that a switch to weightlessness and back can actually be tough on the body. Now, it's true. Now, I'm not talking about a swing set. You actually kind of go weightless for a few seconds while you're swinging on a swing set or while you're parachuting or jumping a jump on a motorcycle or you're riding the Vomit Comet, which is a galaxy-class aircraft that climbs up to about 35,000 feet and then goes into a shallow dive, making the occupants and the cabin area, go weightless for a few seconds, up to 30 seconds. That's why they call it the vomit comet, because most people's tummies can't take that kind of up and down motion. When you go weightless, it's not too bad. But when the plane pulls out of the dive and you go to about 1.5 times your body weight, it squeezes your stomach down into your bowels, and that pretty much does it for everybody. I kind of like it, but most people don't like it. And the centrifuge wasn't too bad, although I can't go past about 3.5 Gs. I pass out and do the duck. The duck, it's a term that we use when you're in the chair. When you pass out, it's not a graceful thing. It's more like a bobbing of the head kind of thing. You don't know it, but people can see it on the camera. It's called the duck. So if you're going to be a fighter pilot, you have to be able to take more than 3.5 Gs. I couldn't. It's a biological thing, physiological thing. They really should give you that test before they put you through flight school, because it's kind of expensive to go through all that school, and then they find out you can't take the Gs, so looks like you're a cargo pilot. Anyway, muscles atrophy if they're weightless for a long time, and the bones likewise lose bone mass. You don't need them. So if you're up in the space station for an extended period of time, according to NASA, astronauts can lose 1% of their bone mass per month in space. Now, I don't know about you, but spending 3 months in space, losing 3% of your bone mass and becoming weak as a kitten, it could take a while to come back. And they don't send young people up there. Well, because you don't have the education, you don't have the experience. You haven't paid your dues to be able to go up if you're young. So you end up going up in your late 30s, early 40s, mid-40s. And I can tell you right now, you miss 2 days in the gym, you might as well miss a month, because the body backslides pretty quickly. Not like when you're young, where you can work out once a month and then go play pro football. When astronauts come back to Earth, their bodies and minds need time to recover. Blood pressure, which is equalized throughout the body in space, has to return to an earthly pattern in which the heart must work hard to keep the brain nourished with blood. Obviously, if you're standing up straight, there's all kinds of valving in the veins of the leg. So when the heart is beating, the blood doesn't rush back to your feet. It stops along the way with these little one-way valves. But still, the heart has to generate enough pressure to move the blood against gravity around the body. Well, obviously, if you're in space, it doesn't have to do that. So occasionally, astronauts struggle with that adjustment. And in 2006, astronaut Heide Marie Stefanchen Piper collapsed at a welcome home ceremony the day after returning from a space shuttle mission to the International Space Station. Yeah, it was only up there for about 4 or 5 days. The mental readjustment can be just as tricky. In 1973, Skylab, for those of you that are too young, we used to have a big trash can up there called Skylab. And those of us that were in college back in the day, when Skylab's orbit decayed and it entered into the atmosphere, we had T-shirts that said, "I survived Skylab." We didn't really know where this hunk of junk was going to come down, and so it was kind of interesting. It fell in the sea. Anyway, Skylab 2 astronaut Jack Luzma told Time magazine that he'd accidentally smashed a bottle of aftershave in his first days back from a month-long sojourn in space. He'd let go of the bottle in midair, forgetting that it would crash to the ground rather than just float there. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? I'd probably do the same thing with a ham sandwich. Interesting. You want to park something in the air, just kind of let it go gently so it won't tumble around or smash into some instrument panel, and it's, of course, there when you get back. But, I think that'd be kind of cool, don't you? Being weightless for a while? Anyway, our phone line is 888-429-5471 if you want to weigh in on any of this. A Drone Wars update. We've been doing Drone Wars updates. We're communicating with Sparky over in the UK. His time exchange is a little bit odd for us, so we're going to have to pre-record his interview and then bring it on for you. He is the expert at Sheffield University in robotics and artificial intelligence and wrote a stunning article on the slippery slope of using drones for civilian work and also overusing them, I think, in combat, how it desensitizes and sort of sanitizes the art of war, making it a little too easy for cyber pilots to kill people at a distance without really feeling the internal pain of doing so. It's kind of a check and balance, I think, in war. But recently, with all of the public fervor about drones being flown over the United States for various reasons, they decided to do a survey. And Terrence Jeffrey wrote this blog. It's kind of interesting. Only 15% of those surveyed are not at all concerned about drones invading privacy. That's pretty amazing that of those people surveyed, only 15% were not at all concerned, which means 85% of the people thought this was a monumentally bad idea. It was conducted at Monmouth University and cited in a Government Accountability Office report published this week. It indicates that these Americans are not happy at all. Only 15% don't care one way or the other. 67% say they are opposed to police using drones to issue speeding tickets. What does that tell you about the way people drive? I mean, if you're a fast driver or if you keep up with the flow of traffic, eventually you're going to get a ticket. Some policeman's going to be hiding behind some bush and is going to get you. But if they're using drones, all of you are going to get tickets. The General Accounting Office, or I'm sorry, General Government Accountability Office, the GAO report, said that law enforcement agencies are the greatest potential users of small drones within the United States. Well, no kidding. I mean, this is revenue central for them. Are you kidding me? They don't have to pay a trooper to go out there on the highway and enforce the law. They can't get enough revenuers on the road. They generate, on average, about $25,000 a week in traffic citations. It's a huge amount of money for local law enforcement. They pay a lot of their city bills with those speeding tickets of people that are passing through their county on the freeways. Absolutely. But if they could catch them all using drones, well, geez Louise, they're standing in line for them. Domestically, state and local enforcement entities represent the greatest potential users of small UAS, these are unmanned aircraft systems, in the near term because they can offer a simple and cost-effective solution for airborne law enforcement activities. I said law, you know, like Judge Dredd. By the way, Dredd came out today. I didn't see it in the theater, but I'm going to. I loved the other two movies. They were really good. For example, federal officials and one airborne law enforcement official said that a small UAS costing between $30,000 and $50,000 is more likely to be purchased by state and local law enforcement entities because the cost is nearly equivalent to that of a patrol car. Ding, 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 ding. You got it. And much less than a manned aircraft. According to an industry trade group, local law enforcement can potentially choose from, get this, 146 different types of small UAS being manufactured by about 69 different companies in the U.S. Now tell me, the drone wars have not generated some jobs, baby. Noting that some Americans, including members of Congress, had questioned the use of drones for conducting surveillance on Americans within the United States. Yeah, that does sound a little amazing, doesn't it? To use a weapon system born in the think tanks of the military for civilian use inside the United States. That does seem to cross the line, doesn't it? Concerns include the potential for increased amounts of government surveillance using technologies placed on these little craft, the collection and use of such data, even if it's accidental, and potential violations of constitutional Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizure. Now, they always come out and say, Earth Explorers, well, you don't have anything to hide, do you? You're not breaking the law out there, are you? Well, if you're not, then you shouldn't have any worry about this. If a little unmanned aircraft flies overhead and just happens to have its camera turned on looking around, if you're not violating the law, why, you have nothing to worry about. Famous last words. Because if no violations can be found and you're spending all that money, what do you think the next iteration of that arrangement is? Ah, that's right. The law gets modified. They start looking for stuff, and if they can't find it, they find it anyway. Sort of like the recent activity that we've had where people have had their weapons taken away from them because they are mentally deficient to be able to own a weapon based on their politics. Aha. Additionally, a June 2012 poll conducted by Monmouth University reported that 42% of those sampled were very concerned about their own privacy if U.S. law enforcement started using UAS with high-tech cameras, while 15% said they were not at all concerned. Well, somewhere in between there, the 42% and the 15%, which only makes 57%, obviously leaving 43% unaccounted for in this survey, there's a lot more gray area here. Monmouth poll surveyed a random sample of 1,708 American adults. Respondents were asked, how concerned would you be about your own privacy if U.S. law enforcement started using unmanned drones with high-tech cameras? Would you be very concerned, somewhat concerned, only a little concerned, or not at all concerned? That's how we would rank a survey. So when you're ranking a survey, only the two extremes are really important. Those are really the ones that you're looking for, the ones that are saying, I'm very concerned about it, or the other ones say, you know what, I don't give a rat's behind about it. You can do what you want up there. Waste all the fuel you want up there. I'm not doing anything wrong. Those are the only two that survey readers care about. But the middle one, the somewhat concerned, only a little concerned, these are people that haven't given it a lot of thought. These are what we call the independents. These are what we call the moderates. These are what we call the swing states. But if they had a little bit more information, oh, they'd make their minds up. Absolutely. You let them get a speeding ticket by mail, and they'll weigh in on it. You let them have some a victory garden that they have in their backyard reported because a drone flew over in the middle of the day when they were at work and saw them growing a garden when they weren't supposed to in a neighborhood that doesn't allow gardens. They'll weigh in on it, I guarantee you. 20% said they'd be somewhat concerned, and 16% said they'd only be a little concerned. Well, let's take the extremes, the 42% that said they would be very concerned, the 15% that they don't care one way or the other, and let's take the 4% of unknown, the 22% said they'd be somewhat concerned, and 16% they'd be only a little concerned, and let's add those together. Aha, now you're talking about 85% of the population. You got 85% of the population that are in between definitely concerned and only a little concerned, and 15% that don't care at all. That's a big difference. Only 23% said they supported the use of drones to issue speeding tickets, while 67% said they opposed that. By the way, speeding is not the primary cause of fatalities on American highways. It absolutely is not. In fact, driving too slow on thoroughfares is responsible for more accidents and more fatalities than speeding, and greater than both of those put together by a whopping factor is alcohol. Alcohol is the number one, and then driving too slow is the number two, and speeding is the number three. But if you get a ticket for driving too slow, your insurance company is not going to raise your rate. You get a ticket for driving too fast, and they will raise your rate. So if you got drones that are handing out tickets electronically to the tune of hundreds a day instead of dozens a day, I guarantee you that this 85%, they're going to weigh in. 80% supported the use of drones in search and rescue missions, and 11% opposed it. So that's just interesting how the drone wars is going. I got a little story here about gravity, and I don't know how much detail I want to get into it. Obviously, if you lived on Pluto and you were a 150-pound person, you'd weigh about 57 pounds. On Mars. On Pluto, a 150-pound person would weigh about 10 pounds. If you lived on Jupiter, you'd weigh 354 pounds. And then if you came back to Earth, well, you could be John Carter. The planet humans are most likely to visit Mars. We'll leave you a little light-footed. You'll weigh about 57 pounds. How would you like to have the quads of a football player, which most astronauts are going to be in that kind of shape, and weigh 57 pounds? Also, we want to be careful on those other planets because some bacteria become nastier in space, a recent study found. It was published in 2007 in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It found that Salmonella, that's a very, very common bacteria that causes food poisoning, becomes three times more virulent in microgravity. Something about the lack of gravity changed the activity of at least 167 Salmonella genes and 73 of its proteins. Mice fed gravity-free Salmonella got sick faster after consuming less of the bacteria. In other words, Michael Crichton's The Andromeda Strain, you remember that movie? Well, it had it all wrong. The danger of infection in space may not come from space bugs. It's more likely our own bugs grown stronger that would strike us. I guess that means that you have to eat all dead food when you go up there. It's all going to have to be irradiated and sterilized and maybe microwaved and dehydrated at the same time. No yogurt. Yeah, the critters in yogurt would definitely become more virulent. Even on Earth, you know, gravity isn't entirely even. Oh, it's true. Because the globe is in a perfect sphere, its mass is distributed unevenly, and uneven mass, according to Newtonian physics, means slightly uneven gravity. One mysterious gravitational anomaly is in the Hudson Bay of Canada. This area has lower gravity than other regions, and a 2007 study finds that melted glaciers are to blame. The ice that once cloaked the area during the last ice age has long since melted, but the Earth hasn't entirely snapped back from the burden, since gravity over an area is proportional to the mass atop that region, and the glacier's imprint pushed aside some of the Earth's mass. Gravity is a bit less strong in the ice sheet's imprint. The slight deformation of the crust explains 25% to 45% of the unusually low gravity. The rest may be explained by a downward drag caused the motion of magma in the Earth's mantle. That's kind of an interesting theory. A lot of the maritime history, and some of it I've been able to cover in interviews with admirals retired in the Navy, they report this phenomenon, which we've talked about occasionally on this program and is one of the key pieces of evidence that we use to explain the possibility that planets form as hollow spheres. The phenomenon is called the oceanic depression. It's not a single location. There are numerous ones of them around the planet. But evidently there are places where sea level is not sea level. And these oceanic depressions, although they have been noticed when, for instance, ships have been sailing side by side from continent to continent, sometimes one ship will lose sight of the other ship for, you know, sometimes several hours at a time. And it's not just, you know, the oceanic swells that cause a ship momentarily to dip below the horizon. It's because one ship sails into this oceanic depression. The two ships might be, oh, let's say 20 miles apart. At 6 feet off the water, you have approximately 8 miles of parallax over the horizon view. And at, you know, 45 or 50 or 60 feet off the water, like you'd get with an ocean-going vessel, you can, of course, see a little bit further. That's why they had crow's nests up in old wooden ships so that you could see, get an early warning, so to speak, looking over the horizon for an enemy ship or an enemy flag. Before that boat ever got a chance to see you, you could turn and hightail it over the curvature of the earth, and that way the pirate would never catch you. Well, in any case, sometimes one of the ships disappears for a number of hours, and that's because it sails down into a lower portion of the ocean. The question that I put to the admiral was, why do you think the ocean dips down like that? And of course, the first, you know, hip shot answer was, oh, well, gravity is not the same all around the planet, and that's probably where gravity is a little bit higher, and it pulls the ocean down deeper. And I thought about that for a second, and I said, well, Admiral, you know, I'm not to, you know, throw your theories off or your experience off at all, but don't you think quite the opposite is true? That the area that's being pulled down deeper actually has less gravity, and that means that the surrounding halo of gravity is actually pulling the water away from that center, leaving the ocean to dip down in that area of lesser gravity. And he thought about that for a minute. He said, you know, that makes a lot of sense. Just kind of interesting. So that's what we have, you know, laying before us when we think about this kind of stuff. I think it's pretty cool that we have some data out there that does make sense, that does seem to support the idea that maybe the crust is not as thick as we think it is everywhere. So, just interesting. Also, I think you've seen a little bit of this on the History Channel. There's a huge experiment that's trying to catch mysterious neutrinos. Those of you that have seen this collector, it's quite large. It's about half the size of a football field, and it's taken a tremendous amount of money to build this because it's built in a very remote area of the South Pole. The detector will catch neutrinos, puzzling chargeless, near-massless particles. And these, I'll put it this way, a neutrino could pass through about a light year of Earth's and not hit anything because Earth just isn't that dense. At most, it's, you know, 8 to 9 grams per cubic centimeter, and it's just not dense enough to stop a neutrino. So obviously the detector has to be made of very, very, you know, dense material to be able to pick up the incidence of collision of these neutrinos passing through. So they have a block of, it's called the NOVA detector. It's, of course, black to prevent light from entering the detector. The physicists have put the first piece in place for the new detector. Neutrinos are all around us, but they rarely collide with other particles, certainly not human beings, and mostly fly through people, buildings, planets, as if it wasn't even there. And some of them can be, you know, quite fast. To study neutrinos, scientists must find them first. Fortunately, the Earth is being hammered by a river of neutrinos almost all the time. So the idea, this particular one I think is built up in northern Minnesota, right against the Canadian border. So the detector is built with a liquid scintillator material, sort of like we use sodium iodide crystal to catch scintillations in the gamma range. And we take that electrical impulse and read that. Well, this is a liquid scintillation material. And it should give a, you know, pretty good response when these neutrinos try to pass through it. It'll give a signal. The NOVA detector is located in Ash River, Minnesota. It'll study a beam of neutrinos originating 500 miles away at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory near Chicago. So we're going to make our own stream of neutrinos and shoot it at it. So September 6th, the technicians began to position the first block of this detector. Marvin Marshak, who is the NOVA laboratory director and director of undergraduate research at the University of Minnesota, said in a statement, "It is a significant step toward a greater understanding of neutrinos. It represents many months of hard work on the part of the whole NOVA collaboration. The detector will comprise 28 blocks in total, each of which weigh 417,000 pounds and measures 51 by 51 by 7 feet. Each block will be painstakingly placed inside a 300-foot-long metal hall, a detector hall. The blocks will be empty when installed, and then they'll be filled with the scintillator liquid once they're in place. About a dozen scientists, engineers, and technicians from Fermilab and Argonne have been up to Ash River multiple times in the past year to make this thing happen. They're part of a team, over 100 collaborators who have been actively working on the experiment. It's scheduled to begin taking place in early 2013. The machine will focus on unraveling the puzzle of neutrino flavors. We call them flavors. That's just the way we talk about subatomic particles. Neutrinos come in three types: electron, muon, and tau, like T-A-U, which are each associated with the elemental particles bearing those names. Neutrinos transform between these flavors at different rates, and the antimatter partner particles of each of these neutrinos change flavors at different rates still. So hopefully we can get some hard data, we can start putting that into the standard model, and we can make predictions about how the universe was formed. It's a much cheaper option than CERN. I think it's a pretty interesting experiment. Another amazing feat of physics came out of Brookhaven's relativistic heavy ion collider this year. In February of 2010, you recall, scientists announced they'd created a quark gluon soup where protons and neutrons had broken up into their constituents' building blocks, which we call quarks and gluons. Oh, yeah, you just thought neutrons were the smallest thing, but they're not. It took extremely powerful collisions of gold atoms. We accelerate gold atoms up to pretty close to the speed of light, and then we slam them into each other, and the nuclei just kind of blow apart. They had to achieve temperatures of around 7 trillion degrees Fahrenheit. These conditions are 250,000 times hotter than the center of the sun and similar to temperatures seen just after the birth of the universe. They were the hottest temperatures ever reached on Earth. Using lithium atoms, scientists recreated an ancient mathematical symbol that had been seen as far back as the second century. Borromean rings. It depicts three rings linked together. If any ring were removed, they'd all come apart. By the way, trapped in between any two of these rings is the Vesica Pisces, which is the basis of the flower of life symbol. Physicists predicted that particles should be able to form this same arrangement, but no one had been able to achieve it until now. The final realization, announced in December of 2009, came 40 years after the prediction. Kind of interesting to see that. The question is, how in the world did ancient peoples know about this pattern? How did they use this pattern in all of their artwork? Kind of interesting, don't you think, that they would have some knowledge of how these subatomic particles arrange themselves? I think it's kind of interesting. Let's go ahead and take a break, a quick 5 minutes or so. Put on a little Liquid Mind, and I'll bring some Rumi to you in a moment. Be right back. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you. right, welcome back to hour two of X Squared Radio. With a little Liquid Mind playing in the background, I'd like to share a little something from Rumi with you. It's a story. The Chinese and the Greeks were arguing as to who were the better artists. The king said, "We'll settle this matter with a debate." The Chinese began talking, but the Greeks wouldn't say anything. They left. The Chinese suggested then that they each be given a room to work on with their artistry. Two rooms facing each other, divided by a curtain. The Chinese asked the king for 100 colors, all the variations, and each morning they came to where the dyes were kept and took them all. The Greeks took no colors. "They're not part of our work," they said. They went to their room and began cleaning and polishing the walls. All day, every day, they made those walls as pure and clear as an open sky. There is a way that leads from all colors to colorlessness. Know that when the magnificent variety of the clouds and the weather comes from the total simplicity of the sun and the moon. The Chinese finished, and they were so happy that they beat the drums in joy of their completion. The king entered their room, astonished by the gorgeous color and detail. The Greeks then pulled the curtain, dividing the rooms. The Chinese figures and images shimmeringly reflected on the clear Greek walls. They lived there, even more beautifully and always changing in the light. The Greek art is the Sufi way. They don't study books of philosophical thought. They make their loving clearer and clearer. No wantings, no anger. In that purity, they receive and reflect the images of every moment. From here, from the stars, from the void. It's a little bit like we should be with one another. Not that you shouldn't go out and create your art, but that the art that is created, the organization of thought, is even more beautiful when it's reflected off those who view it. Maybe that's kind of the way our government should learn to be. Instead of trying to be everything for everybody, creating everything, printing all the money, making all the jobs, creating all the regulations to push society one way or the other way, maybe they should just sit back and reflect the greatness of the human race. Just my thoughts here as we start the second hour of X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of this program. We appreciate you more than you know. I love your mails. I love the thoughts that you have, and I would love for you to contribute in any way you want to. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Don't forget, as you're figuring out where to spend your money this fall, I know you're already saving up for Christmas presents, but these are dire times and requires us to think a little bit about a rainy day. I know some of you like to keep all your money in the bank. It's nice to see those numbers at the bottom of the account. But there was a time, not too far in the past, when the bank started taking holidays. That is to say, they closed the doors and your money was stuck inside the bank. If you think those days are far away, you just ask some of your wealthy friends how hard it is to move money around these days. It's really, really difficult. So just know that when the bank closes, they're taking your 401k and they're taking your savings account with them. Oh, yeah, they're insured to $100,000 or $200,000. What's the difference if you can only access the principal and they have 10 years to pay it back to you? Wouldn't you rather just have it in your hands? I think I'll just hold on to mine until things get a little bit better at the banks. And if you don't want to just have cash, you can have precious metals. I go to APMEX, APMEX.com, to buy my silver. They're not my affiliate. I don't make any money off promoting them. I'm only providing this to you as a public service so that you can take care of yourself. Don't buy the paper. Get the metal. Get the silver metal in your hands. I buy mine in 1 ounce bars just because it's a nice little rectangular slab of 99.999% pure silver that I can exchange for something of value, because silver is going to go up. Right now it's about $38 an ounce. And 4 years ago it was less than 10. Well, it's going to go up. I don't know exactly what day, but this year I would say it's probably going to shoot up through the roof. Might be a good investment for you. And if you're not willing to invest in cash, it just has a good sound, doesn't it? Cash. And you're not willing to invest in silver, then maybe you'll invest in food. Our finest affiliate, the Food Investor, highly recommended. Go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the Food Investor banner on the right-hand side. Awesome quality, great bunch of guys out there in Utah. Delicious food that will last for 30 years. So you can set it and you can forget it. Set your heart at ease. Don't put yourself at the mercy of FEMA. I think it's probably one of the last places that you want to be at the mercy of. Lots of neat things happening in the news. And we're going to cover a little bit of economic science and political science tonight, but I don't want to get a whole lot into it. You know, there's been a lot of things going on over there in the Middle East. And for about a week, it was very confusing for the press to get their story straight, even though those of you that listened to this program knew exactly what was happening. There are sharp opinions on all sides on this, and the temptation to lay blame is almost too great for anyone to resist. But the fact remains that 4 Americans are dead, and they did not die well. The people that perpetrated this planned it very carefully. It was funded very carefully, and they knew exactly what they were doing. And I guess the hard thing about it is that our own State Department knew what they were about to do and did nothing about it. That's the hard thing to follow. If you have an opinion on this, one way or the other, it will be respected here, 888-429-5471. It is clear, abundantly clear, that we are not going to get a clean story from the mainstream media. Not even Fox, not even the cable shows. Some of them are so opinionated you just want to turn them off for good, but you can't resist because the entertainment value is so good. But you will get the straight scoop right here on this program. If you have any questions about it whatsoever, you can email me at bagnew@x2-radio.com and I will openly discuss it with you. A new speech was written and delivered to Mitt Romney this week. Hopefully he will use it, because it is powerful and it gives him something that will really tell the story. I'm sorry, I'm not voting for Romney. I'm voting against Obama. So now you know. They now have a levitating magnet, nuclear fusion, the melding of atomic nuclei that happens inside stars, is a long-sought goal on Earth. If scientists can achieve it, it could offer a powerful source of energy with few negative environmental consequences. Not no risks, but fewer risks. For instance, if a fission reactor goes out of control, we get something like Fukushima, which is a cesium reactor, or Chernobyl, which was another nuclide reactor. But if you lose a fusion reactor, it's only it's only radioactive for about 12 days, and then it's pretty much done. Scientists took a step closer to this goal in January of 2010 when they announced that they'd built a levitating magnet that created some of the conditions thought to be necessary for fusion. By suspending a giant donut-shaped magnet in midair, researchers were able to control the motion of an extremely hot gas of charged particles contained within the magnet's outer chamber. The density of this gas was close to what's needed for nuclear fusion, the researchers said. Now, you need to know what that gas was. It was probably tritium. So tritium is a hydrogen proton with two neutrons. You need the neutrons. They're the same weight as the proton, except those are the particles that become highly energized and actually create the energy when they're slamming about in the chamber. Tritium is what enriches a fusion reaction in a weapon to create the extra energy. It's injected a few billionths of a second after the initial explosion. They've also discovered a new antimatter particle. By smashing particles together at close to light speed inside an atom smasher, scientists created a never-before-seen type of antimatter called an anti-hypertriton. This particle is weird in many ways. First, it's definitely not normal matter, but its eerie opposite called antimatter, which annihilates whatever matter it comes in contact with. Second, the anti-hypertriton is what's called a strange particle, meaning it contains a rare building block called a strange quark, which isn't present in protons and neutrons that makes up regular atoms. The experiment was conducted at the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider at Brookhaven National Laboratory in Upton, New York. The results were announced in March of 2010. We've also already discussed the knots of light. The discovery of a dynamic Earth. Earth is a dynamic sphere. Yes, you heard it right. Independent confirmation. Earth is a dynamic sphere. And, it turns out, so is the planet's climate, otherwise known as the long-term trend of global weather conditions. It's no wonder questions and myths about what exactly is going on in the atmosphere, in the oceans, and on land. How can we tell our orb is actually warming and where the humans are to blame? Well, that's what the whole project is about. The myth is that the sun is to blame. Over the past few hundred years, the sun's activity, including the number of sunspots, has increased, causing the world to get warmer. The science, actually, refutes this. In the last 35 years of global warming, the sun has shown a slight cooling trend while the climate has been heating up, scientists say. In the past century, that is up until 1998, in the past century, solar activity can explain some of the increase in global temperatures, but a relatively small amount. A study published in the journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics in December of 2011, just a few months ago, revealed that even during a prolonged lull in the sun's activity, Earth still continued to warm. The study researchers found that the Earth absorbed 0.58 watts of excess energy per square meter, then escaped back into space during the study period from 2005 to 2010, a time when solar activity was low. However, not everyone agrees with that. The myth is there's no consensus on whether the planet is actually warming, and the science, about 97% of climate scientists agree that human-made global warming is happening. Really? I guess I'm in the 3%. In the scientific field of climate studies, which is informed by many different disciplines, the consensus is demonstrated by the number of scientists who have stopped arguing about what is causing climate change, and that's nearly all of them, according to Skeptical Science, a website dedicated to explaining the science of global warming. Well, there's a lot more argument to come, I'm afraid, on that. So, anyway, we'll either start the argument right here on X Squared Radio, or we will finish the argument right here on X Squared Radio. By the way, the highest resolution camera ever built has begun its quest to pin down the mysterious stuff that makes up nearly three-quarters of our universe. Yeah, you know what that is, right? That's right. Dark energy. The dark energy surveys 570 million pixel camera will scan some 300 million galaxies in the coming 5 years. The goal is to discover the nature of dark energy, which is theorized to be responsible for the ever faster expansion of the universe. Its first image, taken the 12th of this month, focused on the Fornax galaxy cluster. In time, along with its massive hall of individual galaxies, it will study 100,000 galaxy clusters. These are clusters of numerous galaxies. The largest stable structures we know of, and 4,000 supernova, the bright, dying, death throes of stars out there. We have discussed that many times on this program. This enormous survey is a collaboration between U.S., U.K., Brazilian, Spanish, and German astronomers. The phone box-sized dark energy camera, or DCAM, is mounted on the 4-meter Victor M. Blanco telescope at the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory in Chile's Atacama Desert. The DCAM is particularly sensitive to red and infrared light to better study cosmic objects at as distant as 8 billion light years away. More distant objects are moving away from us and each other faster than nearer objects, which causes a shift of their apparent color toward the red end of the spectrum. It's called a red shift. A blue shift would be coming toward us. Some galaxies are moving so fast away from our galaxy that we will never see them. Careful studies of the shifted light from distant supernova were what first demonstrates this expansion, leading to the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics. What is believed to be causing this increase in the speed of expansion is called dark energy, making up more than 70% of the stuff of the universe and the focus of the DCAM's mission. Other efforts hope to get to the bottom of the mystery, including the BOSS survey and a future space telescope dedicated to the effort called Euclid. But for now, Will Percival from the University of Portsmouth, a dark energy survey collaborator, he says that the DCAM is an exciting prospect. This will be the largest galaxy survey of its kind, and the galaxy shapes and positions will tell us a great deal about the nature of the physical process that we call dark energy, but do not currently understand. The survey will tackle the problem in four ways. It will study the same kind of supernova that led to the Nobel Prize in a bid to unravel the expansion history of the universe when its expansion increased and decreased over billions of years. And it will also map out the 3D distribution of galaxy clusters, measuring what are known as baryon acoustic oscillations, literally relics of the sound echoes of the Big Bang. Dark energy and dark matter mysteries. Gravity acting across vast distances does not seem to explain what astronomers see. It should be very powerful where we do see mass in space, and not so powerful where we do not see mass in space, you know, the dark open spaces. It's good grapefruit juice. Galaxies, for example, should fly apart. It just should because of the centripetal force and desire to, travel in a straight line. Some other mass must be there holding them together. Astrophysicists have thus postulated dark matter, invisible to us, but It's clearly acting on galactic scales. At the greatest distances, the universe's expansion is accelerating, which means that energy and matter has got to be coming from somewhere, even if it's not visible. Thus, we also have dark energy, which acts to drive the expansion in opposition to gravity that we see with our eyes, at least with mass that we see with our eyes, stars and planets, etc. The current theory holds that 73% of the universe is dark energy, 23% is dark matter, and only 4% is the kind of matter that we can see in our telescopes. Which is kind of interesting if you think about it, because it confirms the idea that dark energy and dark matter is some kind of chaos. It's some kind of homogeneous, albeit heavy, chaos. And that the matter that we see, the stars and planets, galaxies, you know, quasars, etc., is the random sort of noise that for some reason spontaneously develops into the matter that we see. Now, ordinarily we would say something like, well, gee, that sounds like order out of chaos to me. Indeed it is. And it does seem to fit the mathematical equation that we see as a result as the Fibonacci spiral. That is to say, you can start from zero, you can add one to it and you get one. You add one to one, you get two. One to two, you get three. And it continues to go forward from there. You know, 1, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34. On and on and on. By the time you get to 144, which you started from zero, you take the last two numbers in the iteration, divide one into the other, and you get 1.618 to 1. That happens to be the golden mean. That is the slope of creation. And interestingly enough, as far as you want to go out on that sequence, that spiralic sequence, you can divide any two numbers together, and you will get 1.618 to 1. Very, very close to it, only variating or variety in the fourth decimal place. Now, the remarkable thing is, of course, you don't always start with zero. You can start in the middle of any number line you want, anywhere. You could take any two numbers, any two random numbers, short-circuit it if you want, add them together and continue that iterative process. And by the time you get out eight iterations, you divide the seventh number into the eighth number, and bam, you get 1.618 to 1. Way out there in the fourth decimal place, some noise around this slope. Which leads one to believe that when matter can resonate, that is to say, it can vibrate at a harmonic frequency so that it adds on top of itself, you will create matter from energy. The biggest question of all, and I tried to answer it in the book Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is does consciousness become involved with that process? And if it does it accelerate or manipulate or observe into reality that sequence which results in matter from energy? Just a pretty cool thought. You can read about it in the book Remembering the Future. And speaking of chaos, there was a lot of chaos caused this week in the religious world. Some of you may have heard of this article. I think it's pretty remarkable. First of all, that this particular artifact was kept in secret for so long. And, of course, second, that the darn thing survived long enough, knowing that that this little fragment had so many enemies to its existence. And three, that the authentic community may actually be drawing the right conclusion from this little fragment. Turns out in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a historian of early Christianity at Harvard Divinity School has identified a scrap of papyrus that she says was written in Coptic in the 4th century. and it contains a phrase never seen in any piece of scripture. So they say, Jesus said to them, my wife. That's it. Jesus said to them, my wife. Evan McGlynn wrote this article. Professor Karen L. King, in her office at Harvard Divinity School, held a fragment of papyrus that she says was written in Coptic in the 4th century and contains a reference to Jesus' wife. The faded papyrus fragment is smaller than a business card, with 8 lines on it, in black ink, legible under a magnifying glass. Just below the line about Jesus having a wife, the papyrus included a second provocative clause that purportedly says, she will be able to be my disciple. The finding was made public in Rome on Tuesday of this week at the International Congress of Coptic Studies by Karen L. King, a historian who has published several books about new gospel discoveries, and is the first woman to hold the nation's oldest endowed chair, the Holus Professor of Divinity. The provenance of the papyrus fragment is a mystery, and its owner has asked to remain anonymous. Until Tuesday, Dr. King had shown the fragment to only a small circle of experts in papyrology and Coptic linguistics who concluded that it is most likely not a forgery. But she and her collaborators say they are eager for more scholars to weigh in and perhaps upend their conclusions. Even with many questions unsettled, the discovery could reignite the debate over whether Jesus was married, whether Mary Magdalene was his wife, and whether he had a female disciple. These debates date to the early centuries of Christianity, scholars say. By the way, those that argued the position were summarily beheaded. At least we don't do that today. But the argument is relevant today when global Christianity is roiling over the place of women in the ministry and the boundaries of marriage. The discussion is particularly animated in the Roman Catholic Church, where despite calls for change, the Vatican has reiterated the teaching that the priesthood cannot be open to women and married men because of the model set by Jesus. Dun, dun, dun. Dr. King gave an interview and showed the papyrus fragment encased in glass to reporters from the New York Times, the Boston Globe, Harvard Magazine, and her Garrett office in the tower at Harvard Divinity School last Thursday. She repeatedly cautioned that this fragment should not be taken as proof that Jesus, the historical person, was actually married. The text was probably written centuries after Jesus lived, and all other early historically reliable Christian literature is silent on the question, she said. But the discovery is exciting, Dr. King said, because it is the first known statement from antiquity that refers to Jesus speaking of a wife. It provides further evidence that there was an active discussion among early Christians about whether Jesus was celibate or married, and which path his followers should choose. This fragment suggests that some early Christians had a tradition that Jesus was married, she said. There was, we already know, a controversy in the 2nd century over whether Jesus was married, caught up with the debate about whether Christians should marry and have sex. Dr. King first learned about what she calls the gospel of Jesus' wife when she received an email in 2010 from a private collector who asked her to translate it. Dr. King, 58, specializes in Coptic literature and has written books on the Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Mary of Magdala, Gnosticism, and Women in Antiquity. The owner, who has a collection of Greek, Coptic, and Arabic papyri, is not willing to be identified by name, nationality, or location, because Dr. King said he doesn't want to be hounded by people who want to buy it. When, where, or how the fragment was discovered is also unknown. The collector acquired it in a batch of papyri in 1997 from the previous owner, a German. It came with a handwritten note in German that names a professor of Egyptology in Berlin, now deceased, and cited him calling the fragment the sole example of a text in which Jesus claims a wife. The owner took the fragment to the Divinity School in December of 2011, left it with Dr. King. In March, she carried the fragment in her red handbag to New York to show it to two papyrologists, Roger Bagnall, director of the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World at New York University, and Anne-Marie Lujendic. Wow, that's hard to say. That's looks like Hungarian. An associate professor of religion at Princeton University. They examined the scrap under sharp magnification. It was very small, only 4 by 8 centimeters. The lettering was splotchy and uneven, the hand of an amateur, but not unusual for the time period when many Christians were poor and persecuted. Just really interesting stuff, don't you think? What do you think about that? Do you think Jesus was married? 888-429-5471. Interesting question, don't you think? It's written in Coptic, an Egyptian language that uses Greek characters, and more precisely, in Sahidic Coptic, a dialect from southern Egypt. Now, the reason that's important, when if you ever go to Egypt, which you probably won't now because it's kind of not a safe place for Americans, when you meet someone out of, I don't know, maybe respect or envy, it's hard to tell from the tone of voice, but they will say, O Asaidi. And it means southern Egypt is the headwaters of the Nile. It means the city. It means you're a wealthy man. It means you're a wealthy merchant. So when you talk about Sahidic Coptic, it means, you know, upper Egypt, which is southern Egypt. As you know, the Nile flows from south to north. So it's the headwaters of the Nile, which is considered, you know, sort of hoity-toity, more knowledgeable, more leadership, more wealth associated to it. Of course, I would always respond, Aomda. Aomda means I'm actually a country boy. I'm not from this city. And that would elicit an interesting response from them. Most of the people that would say, O Asaidi, would sort of look at an American as a rich person because we have a tendency to throw a lot of tip money around and buy things and take them home with us. And so to have someone not only understand their words, Owa Saidi, but come back and say, Owa Aomda, Aomda, which means I'm a country boy, they're going to recognize that. They're going to associate with that. Of course, I always had my associate with me who speaks better Arabic than I do, Greg, who is Ahali's husband. This is the group with Spirit Quest Tours that runs the Bali Quest, you know, the Eat, Pray, Love Tour. Well, they're the ones that do the Eat, Pray, Love Tour. But they also did conduct many tours to Egypt, and I went with them a couple of times, and it was definitely worthwhile. But anyway, Greg would be walking with me, and I would simply point to him and say, Owa Saidi. Aomda means I'm a country boy. I would point to him and say, Owa Saidi, which means he's the city boy. He's from southern Egypt. So anyway, that's where when you hear the term Sahidic Coptic, that's where it comes from. It means southern Egypt, Cairo, you know, the city where the headwaters of the Nile are. What convinced them it was probably genuine was the fading of the ink on the papyrus fibers, and traces of ink adhered to the bent fibers at the torn edges. The backside is so faint that only five words are visible, one only partly, my mother, three and fourth witch. It would be impossible to forge, said the Hungarian doctor who contributed to Dr. King's paper. Dr. Bagnall reasoned that a forger would have to be an expert in Coptic grammar, handwriting, and ideas. Most forgeries he has seen were nothing more than gibberish, and if it were a forgery intended to cause a sensation or make someone rich, why would they have lain in obscurity for so many years? It's hard to construct a scenario that is at all plausible in which someone fakes something like this. The world is not really crawling with crooked papyrologists, said Bagnall. The piece is torn into a rough rectangle so that the document is missing its adjoining text on the left, right, top, and bottom. Most likely the work of a dealer who divided up a larger piece to maximize his profit, Dr. Bagnall said. That's probably the more interesting part about this study, is the fact that this was not cut. It was torn. It was ripped into smaller pieces. Because why? The same reason every antiquity goes through this. Everything that I have seen in the Middle East does this. The people that discover it know absolutely nothing about it. They have no desire to preserve it. They don't want to know who was involved in it, what's written on it, how it affects history, what it means for them, because they reject everything prior to them. The only thing they're interested in is how much can I sell it for? And if I can tear this document into multiple pieces, I can sell it over and over and over again, and I can make a fortune. That's what makes this more genuine than anything else. Much of the content, therefore, is missing, but Dr. King was struck by phrases in the fabric like, my mother gave to me life, and Mary is worthy of it, which resembles snippets from the Gospels of Thomas and Mary, which she also translated. Experts believe those were written in the late 2nd century and translated into Coptic. She surmises that this fragment is also copied from a 2nd century Greek text. The meaning of the words, my wife, is beyond question, Dr. King said. These words can mean nothing else. The text beyond my wife is cut off. Dr. King did not have the ink dated using carbon testing. She said it would require scraping off too much, destroying the relic. She still plans to have the ink tested by spectroscopy, which could roughly determine its age by chemical composition. Dr. King submitted her paper to the Harvard Theological Review, which asked three scholars to review it. Two questions its authenticity, but as usual, they had seen only low-resolution photographs of the fragment and were unaware that expert papyrologists had seen the actual item and judged it to be genuine, Dr. King said. That is so like the scientific community, to just reject things that do not fit their paradigm. One of the two questioned the grammar, translation, and interpretation. Ariel Shisha Halevi, an eminent Coptic linguist at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, was consulted and said in an email in this month, actually, I believe on the basis of the language and grammar, the text is authentic. Major doubts allayed, the review plans to publish Dr. King's article in its January issue. Dr. King said she would push the owner to come forward, in part to avoid stoking conspiracy theories. The notion that Jesus had a wife was the central conceit of the bestseller and movie The Da Vinci Code, but Dr. King said she wants nothing to do with the code or its author. And she says, at least don't say this proves Dan Brown was right. Well, la-di-da-di-da. Let's talk to Brad online, too, see what he has to say. Brad, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing excellent. What's up?
Just trying to figure out, have y'all ever seen any orbs?
The orb you're talking about, is this the book by Michal Ledwith, or are you talking about the movie with Dustin Hoffman?
The movie with Dustin Hoffman.
Yes, absolutely. A deep sea orb was found and was sent down as a translator.
Yeah, do you know that girl that was in there? I think she was a brunette.
Yes.
Yeah, she's got a nice rack on her.
Come on. Oh, it's only flesh, man. It was a good movie, I thought.
I thought so, too. I was wanting to orb her.
Oh, my goodness. Have you called into the right program? Okay. Let's talk about the science of what we're talking about here. What do you think about the idea that Jesus had a wife?
Oh, shit. I think he was a pretty cool dude myself. Man, he was running around, making kids. Man, he did a lot.
Well, listen, I appreciate the call. You can call back anytime you want. We'll discuss the deeper portions of this. I think it's kind of interesting that, Jesus was teaching us about his way of living. And I always thought it was interesting that he did not live a celibate life, that he actually loved Mary very much, as is definitely exampled by after his resurrection. When he came back, the very, very first person that he appeared to was Mary. He could have appeared to anybody, but he thought enough of her to appear to her first. And that was very, very important to me. I thought that was just a fantastic motion of honor. And he didn't just, say, hey, how you doing? What's up? He said, I want you to go tell the others. So he empowered her to go and tell them. Oh, and by the way, he put the appearance before one other as well. Because you'll remember when he said, Mary, and of course then she recognized his voice because she did not recognize him at first. She wanted to know what they had done with her master. Her first instinct was to hug him, and he backed off just a little bit and said, touch me not, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. That means he put her over God. Isn't that great? That the very first thing he did once he was resurrected is he appeared to Mary, and then he went back to his Father. Now that's love. That's the way it goes. I thought it was a great example. I learned a lot from that passage. It makes complete sense to me that he set the example of loving his wife over his parent. Quite an outstanding thought, isn't it? By the way, lots of neat stuff happening out in the ocean right now. I mean the Northwest Ocean. You're going to be fascinated at this. This is really a neat realization. Did you know that there's a joint fleet exercise that's happening in the Northern California Sea between China and U.S. vessels, and they're actually fending off a UFO threat? It's true. This last week, reports of Chinese naval vessels off the U.S. coast, Northern California in particular, have been reported but denied. Now, an Asian intelligence agency reports that a combined fleet operation between the U.S. and China has been going on, a full combat operation against what we are told is a highly unfriendly extraterrestrial threat. The verifications of the fleet operations have been many, and there have been no confirmations from the U.S. side, though the ships have been seen by every vessel that makes it offshore. The true nature of both the threat and the extent of the multinational military force used is beyond any imaginable classification level. Here are the rumors that there are extraterrestrial craft that are operating from underwater bases. Who knew that there are advanced U.S. suborbital weapons platforms represented as tested have actually been deployed from Vandenberg Air Force Base? These are armed with energy weapons. That UFO tracking has been moved from conventional to nanotechnology, with microscopic sensors being used to detect behaviors such as dimensional rifts and distortions in time. Things only discussed in TV shows like Fringe and X-Files. Well, the actual classified memo on very short distribution mentions only the following. Are you ready for this? Opposition is extraterrestrial and extremely aggressive and unfriendly. The threat represents a clear and present danger and is isolated to the Pacific Basin. China is forced to carry U.S. responsibility because our own naval capability is sitting in the Persian Gulf when America is under a very real threat. Attempts to seek confirmations or to directly verify these operations will lead to fatal consequences. Our confirmations limit us to this response, which I have chosen to represent in a highly deniable form out of a personal interest. Others in the U.S. have better information and sources and have been silenced with warnings only. For several months earlier this year, there had been disclosures tied to the UFO issue. One real sighting had been made over South Korea. After that, the internet had been flooded. Yes, Google's YouTube with manufactured phony UFO videos, some of beyond next-generation quality. All information given on how UFO videos or photos are analyzed is totally false. And it's, believe me, it's bush league, it's childish. Especially that from the UFO networks. They are professionally self-discrediting. About 6 weeks ago, a study group was appointed out of NATO and another one in Asia to look at the pattern of UFO videos. A decision was made to aggressively investigate one or more groups. Being aggressively investigated on such an issue is not recommended. Yeah, it's a little bit like a forcible proctology. I would love to be more entertaining, invent things, speculate more, perhaps include some fascinating videos, but I'm not going to. I either have to give this a 70% or reclassify a reliable official source as purposefully leaking something that makes no sense. My suggestion is that readers follow other stories for verifications or information that would help in some way. Add it to the comment section of these videos that you see, and let's get the trash cleaned up here. But we definitely know that these ships are in maneuver. We definitely know that the feeling is, the consensus is that this is not a friendly presence. So, just some interesting stuff. If you know anybody out there you can get a hold of, you should do so. Because I think it's not only a fascinating story, but if it's even halfway true, we've got a real problem on our hands in the Pacific Northwest. Wrapping up this hour, could someone really destroy the whole internet? There are actually a couple of stories on this out there. In just 40 years, our whole civilization has become dependent on the internet. Well, I don't think it's 40 years. The internet really didn't become available to most households until 1996. So that would be something like 16 years. And that's a little bit different of a story there. Let's see. Yeah. 16 years, maybe, I don't know, a dozen years, high-speed internet available to people. And websites, you know, first starting out, well, to tell you the truth, it was mostly porn. But, you know, there were some libraries that were beginning to come on. I remember the Thomas Register used to be a big, long set of, I think it was 24 volumes of green books. It was literally the Bible in any kind of manufacturing done in America. Everything from ball bearings to aircraft wings to medical devices to, you know, coatings, glass, fibers, bolts, you name it. Well, I contacted the Thomas Register one day and I said, listen, have you guys got an online version of your Thomas Register? They said, yeah, we're launching it this year. And so when they launched it, we still had the big green volumes. And believe me, they take up several shelves. These books are like 3 inches thick, small print, big books. Now the entire Thomas Register is online because back in the day, 96, 97, there were something like 5,000 companies a month launching websites, because when you went to the Thomas Register online, not only could you find that ball bearing supplier, but you could go to their website, you could contact them, you could get a quote, and you could do all this in a matter of an afternoon, which was unheard of. It took 30 days to do that stuff with the old Thomas Register. You had to, you know, send them a letter, you know, in the mail, and then they would get it and they would read it and they would send you some brochures back, and then maybe they would send a factory rep out to you, and that's the way it was done. Now we can put all this stuff together. We can send blueprints out and get a quote back on the same day. It is amazing how fast things can go. But the question is, you know, what really is the internet? Is it a single big library of Alexandria? No, it's not. In fact, one of the beauties of it is that it is massively decentralized. So when you hear activist groups threatening to crash the whole thing, or doomsday preppers warning of global internet failure, it's pretty scary. But could someone actually bring the entire internet down? Well, we asked an expert. Taking down the internet is a lot easier said than done, according to IT expert Dwayne Hendricks. And the internet is very much here to stay. Known as the broadband cowboy, Hendricks has worked with AT&T, Cisco, WorldCom, and Lucent, which is one of the Ma Bell stepchildren, and is currently CEO of Tetherless Access, Inc. He says the first thing you have to know about the internet is that there's no such thing as the internet. The internet, says Hendricks, is merely a series of highly distributed packet switchers. Most people get this wrong, he argues. People tend to think it's this one thing, and it's not. And I concur with that. It's important to get this idea across that it's thousands of independently owned and operated networks, networks that are tied together by physical connections that use a common protocol. It's this very quality, this very decentralized, scattered, you know, over-connected quality that has endowed the internet with the capacity to not just remain live and active under extreme circumstances, but to repair itself and adapt when necessary. Taking the internet down, therefore, is very much like trying to herd cats. It's essentially a network of networks. And indeed, there has been some speculation about what it would take to bring down the entire internet. Likewise, you know, many public officials, many elected officials, not the least of which is the President of the United States, has openly executive ordered, and has been openly given the scepter of the giant internet switch to be able to switch off the internet, turn it off. Utter, complete nonsense. Earlier this year, Gizmodo's Sam Biddle made a heroic effort at trying to figure out how to destroy the internet, suggesting that it could be done, however unlikely, by cutting all the cables that bind the internet together, ruining the root servers and destroying all the data centers. Assuming this can be done, which I highly doubt, all the world's digital data would be left frozen on local machines. Nothing can get anywhere because all the roads, bridges, and traffic lights are in ruin, Biddle writes. All that's left of the internet is your office intranet that's inside your building, or the file swapping in your dorm. The tiny shreds, there are nets, but none of them are inter. Unfortunately for Mr. Biddle, he's not exactly correct. What he failed to realize is that where there's people, there's an internet. Taking a step back from Biddle's quasi-apocalyptic scenario and assuming the onset of more modest attacks against the internet, there's no question that disruption can and will happen. My goodness, they happen, you know, when iPower goes down in Southern California or when Microsoft begins to go down up there in Moses Lake, Washington. You're going to have parts of the net that go down from time to time, making it inaccessible for some, albeit temporarily. Eventually, the information will route around the dead spots and bring you back in. And indeed, people are constantly trying to develop new technologies that can take out increasingly larger swaths of the internet. We call this cyber warfare. But their efforts are as futile as they are naive. There are attacks all the time. But all that needs to happen are mutually agreed upon countermeasures. For example, he explains how there are currently two internet protocols in play. There's IPv4 and there's IPv6. Should anyone be successful at taking down all the addresses of IPv6, there's still IPv4 as a backup. Moreover, if anyone can run a DNS server and establish a root DNS to create a database of URLs and corresponding IPs, well, there you go. Hendricks also describes how adjustments like configuration changes to routers, the use of alternative root servers, and other on-the-fly adaptations make things like denial of service, that's known as DOS, and other cyber attacks merely temporary inconveniences. They're like mosquito bites on an elephant. Hendricks points to another very real example, the darknet. Yeah, you don't even know what that is. This is a private, distributed, peer-to-peer file-sharing network, and it has eluded law enforcement officials who are trying to develop new techniques to take it down. But by using non-standard protocols and ports and by using anonymous routing techniques, the darknet remains unhindered. What would you say if I told you roughly 65 to 70% of the internet isn't even accessible by you? You can't find it because the search engines don't see it. You have to know the exact address to get into these things. They don't list. Google doesn't find them. Yahoo doesn't find them. None of these search engines recognize these websites because they're not registered. They're just huge databases. They're portals that you can go into if and only if you know the address, and some of these are very complex. It's known as the darknet, and it makes up the majority of the internet. There's also the issue of China, a country that has tried to block out large swaths of the internet, and it has not done so very successfully. There are a good number of people who have the technical skills to get around their blocking measures. Quoting computer scientist John Gilmore, he noted that the net interprets censorship as damage, and it routes around it. And let me tell you something. All you need is a cell phone. That's it. You can create a mobile portal using a cell phone. Anywhere that you can get a cell connection, you can have an internet connection. And you can simply just route around it. It's kind of like fighting the Borg. The internet works like the Borg Collective, you know, in Star Trek. It's basically a kind of hive mind, essentially because it's in everybody's best interest to keep the internet up and running. You can't make a bank deposit. You can't use your debit card. You can't pump gas. You can't make a phone call. You can't do anything without the internet anymore. It is it to everyone's advantage, whether you're running a roadside fruit stand or whether you're running an investment bank. It's in everybody's best interest to keep the net up and running. Nobody, not the Prime Minister of China and not the President of the United States, can shut off the internet. There's a constant effort to patch and repair any problems. It's like trying to defeat the Borg, a system that's massively distributed, decentralized, and redundant. Like the Borg, the internet simply mounts resources and finds a way to bring itself back to life. It also learns and it adapts, like ensuring that packets aren't routed to networks that aren't trusted. The internet is people, and it works like a hive mind. The ability to retain access to the internet's resources is essentially about maintaining connections. All of these connections are real. For example, there would still be the low Earth communication satellites that allocate a portion of bandwidth to regular IP traffic. These commsats would establish connections between wireless devices or any other terminal that still has access to fiber cables. As an example, this is how the military reestablished connections after the 2006 tsunami disaster in Thailand. They set up a satellite connection from one point, sent their signals up into space, then down to a receiving terminal, instant network. By assuming these satellites could somehow be taken down, which would really require major military action, there's still the potential for single packet radios, a form of packet switching technology that's used to transmit digital data via radio or wireless links. If enough people have access to these devices and each unit is within range of at least one other packet radio, there will still be an internet. And according to Hendricks, devices like these are the real deal. With over 4,000 wireless IPs in the United States alone, such devices could be propped up in weather balloons or UAVs and tracked using GPS. Now, this may not be the internet that we're familiar with today, but it will be a network that connects people nonetheless. These seed networks might start out small, but they would grow over time, especially when they start to come into contact with other recovering networks. Remember, the internet is not smartphones and laptops and PCs and modems. It's people. Hendricks points to a real-world example in which IT infrastructures were severely compromised, including New Orleans after Katrina. I was there, and Egypt during the uprisings. Both of these regions had temporary disruptions, but they were up in a startlingly short amount of time. These examples bring another aspect of the internet to mind, that the idea that people will quickly scramble to restore damaged infrastructure. Now that we have the internet, we have become like ants who have had their anthills swept away by a storm. Quickly scramble to work and restore the network. Thinking more catastrophically, we asked Hendricks, what would happen in the event of a massive EMP, which is an electromagnetic pulse? And the answer is pretty amazing. No global EMP or cascade is going to cover the entire planet. That's for sure. It's only going to strike one side at a time. The internet will survive, even local EMPs. He believes that the portions of the world who did still have the internet would send supplies to areas that didn't and quickly reestablish their communications infrastructure. The internet would be up much quicker than we think. And that's kind of the remarkable thing about it, that if we have a local event occur, it isn't going to take everybody out. The internet is not just this technology. I told you, it's people. The only way to bring down the internet is to get rid of all the people. obviously, all the people are gone. There won't be any smartphones, and nothing will be around. Hey, let's go ahead and take a quick 5-minute break. We'll listen to the Alice Band for a minute, give my voice a little bit of a rest, and we'll open the phone lines again, and hopefully we'll have somebody that's listening and on the ball. Don't go away. We'll be right back. More X Squared Radio after this.
I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio, our third hour. Lots of interesting stuff happening out there. I can tell you, we have about 42 days before the 2012 presidential election. Obviously, this is going to be an interesting archive because after the election, people go back and listen to this and say, oh, this is what was happening before the election. You know, we really have a unique situation here. We have two candidates who are, it looks like the one that's going to pull in front is the one that makes the least number of mistakes. And it's really an interesting scenario because I think on both sides we have some great things that have been done or trying to be done. And yet we do not have a free and open press like we once had in this country. We have a media that is dedicated to perpetuating the status quo, which is in the White House right now. And for the life of me, I can't figure it out. I don't understand where the value proposition is. You know, when we talk about philosophy, you always want to look for the good in whatever the philosophy is that's being purported. If you can find that, then you can at least put some basis of a thought process behind what's going on. So when you try to put a finger on what the good of the current administration is, it seems to be the goal is to have everyone working for the federal government. If everyone works for the federal government, then everyone's employed. Everyone has an income coming in. The thing I don't understand, the thing where I'm missing the point is, the only reason, the only way, the only function of how they would have an income is if the money was first taken from someone outside the system that's producing. But if everyone works for the government, then no one is outside the system producing. So therefore, everybody's employed, but nobody's employed because we're all living off of waste products. You know, taxes are sort of the leftover, the crumbs of productivity. When we build a car or grow a corn stalk or we synthesize a chemical, you put it into drums on boats and trucks and you sell it to someone who buys it with the money that they earn doing their thing. And that system of commerce is supposed to be slightly taxed in order to run the system that makes sure that everything runs smoothly. Commerce Department, that, you know, international trade, national defense, general welfare, education, etc. But we've become a system that is literally buying its own future. It's sort of like a perpetual motion machine. Okay, you put it on the table and you're looking at it. You've built it. It's sitting there, but it's not moving. Nothing's happening. It's just a lump of metal and low friction bearings sitting there. And then you reach forward and you give it a spin. Now, when you give it a spin, it starts to go around and around, and whatever weight is there clicks and clacks and, you know, swings around, and the darn thing just continues to move. Now, assuming that the bearings have zero friction, which is kind of a big assumption since no bearing has ever been invented that doesn't have any friction, and assuming that there's no energy loss due to wind resistance or imperfections in the balance of the machine, everything is perfect, and it's sitting there in a perfect vacuum and has frictionless bearings, then the thing is going to spin forever. But the instant you try to pull some energy out of it that's more than what you put into it, that first initial sling, you know, the darn thing's going to stop. Why? Well, because you can't get out more than what you put in. That's just the rules that are set up in this universe. Forget about perpetual motion, because it doesn't happen. There's always drag in the bearings. There's always drag due to wind resistance. There's always drag due to imperfections in the balance of the machine. And so there is no perpetual motion. You constantly have to put something in. Well, that's pretty much exactly what we're talking about here. You constantly have to put something into the monetary system in order to get something out. A food stamp, a welfare payment, a Medicaid check. You got to put something into it to get something out of it. Well, the input are what's called working people, people that have a job, whether they're picking cucumbers, painting cars, engineering steel beams, you know, processing human resource materials. They're doing something for that income. The people that work for the federal government actually don't do anything, okay? They are the bearings that have drag. They are the wind resistance. They are the imbalance in the machinery. The only input, that is to say the power or energy that gave the darn thing the sling in the first place, is us. We're the ones that give it that sling. So if you end up hiring everyone in the federal government, there's no input. The entire thing drags to a stop. Now, we're really close to that now, Earth Explorers. There are so many people pulling out of the system. There's nobody there to pedal the darn thing faster. So the thought process, well, gee, we'll just raise the taxes on the most productive. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's never worked. It's been tried 100 times over 1,000 years all around the world, and it never, ever works. Only way to make it work is to put more people to work in the private sector. And the only way to do that is to create employers in the private sector, which means somebody somewhere has to go into business. Now, herein lies the paradox. Let's suppose that you own a small company with 20 or 30 employees, and one day you decide to run an ad to hire a new accountant because you need somebody to do your books. And so you put an ad in the paper or you put an ad on Monster and you get a half a dozen resumes in the mail. And you read through them and you decide one of those candidates looks really good on paper. Let's go ahead and get him in for a face-to-face. So you make the contact. The candidate comes in. He's dressed right. He looks right. He's got a great personality. He's a halfway decent golfer. And he comes in and knocks every question over the wall. Just the perfect candidate. And then comes the final question. Let's just say his name is Mr. Jones. So tell me, Mr. Jones, where are you working now? And Mr. Jones, with a confident smile on his face, his perfectly manicured fingers, and his brilliant accountant mind, comes back with a smile and says, oh, I'm not working anywhere right now. I'm immediately available. And the answer from HR is, oh, I'm sorry. We can only hire people that are already working. Do you see how stupid that sounds? Do you see how utterly ridiculous of a business model that is? To say you couldn't hire the perfect candidate because he's not already working? Is that not the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard in your whole life? Can I see a show of hands? Well, okay, that's about 100% of the people. Then you understood my analogy perfectly. But believe me when I tell you, that is exactly what is happening every single day in every single town all around America. Well, not exactly. You see, what happens is the small business goes into the bank, and the bank looks at the pro forma. That's the projection of the sales, of the cash flow, of the number of people that will be hired, of the taxes that they'll pay, of the huge deposits that this company will make over the next 5 years into their bank. A perfect match. A perfect match. A business that wants to form in town, creating a payroll account, creating an inventory account, everything a bank could ever hope for. Except there's one problem. The business isn't already in business. It has experienced experts in the area with more than 25 years experience in the area that they're meaning to go in. They have the mailing list. They have the contacts. They have the supply chain. They have their building. They've even invested their own money. They're ready to go to work. They're immediately available. But the bank, like the hypothetical HR department, says, oh, I'm so sorry. You're not already in business? There's nothing we can do. You see how utterly, ridiculously ignorant and stupid that is? That is exactly why this nation and the world is on its ass right now. Because that attitude, that system, that relationship happens every day in every bank in this country. I know you have an opinion on that. 888-429-5471. Do we really need to tax the rich? Do we really need to take the most productive, best providers that we have in our nation and take everything they have and give it to the federal government? Do you really think that's the answer? I cannot possibly believe that 47% of the United States of America honestly believes that that is a system of success, that that's a system to prosperity. Because I'm a halfway decent mathematician. I'm more than a halfway decent scientist, with 30 years of proven success at it. And I think it's the most ridiculous, ignorant, backwards way of looking at things that I've ever seen. How utterly ridiculous it is that you wouldn't hire a person that's not already working. how utterly ridiculous it is that you wouldn't fund a company that's ready to go into business, hire people, stimulate the economy the old-fashioned way by working for it. But they won't. And so trillions of dollars sit idly by in all those bank accounts so that the owners and the shareholders of those banks can sit around and trade your money in different currencies back and forth all month long so they can make 20, 30, 40, 50, even 60% interest. Oh, yeah. You think credit card rates are high? People, it's nothing. Nothing compared to what the banks are making in profits. 40 to 60%, and they're taking no risk at all because it's your money they're playing with. And to have the audacity, the arrogance, the gall, the condescending nature to look at an honest businessman who walks in through their front door and says, I would like a loan so that I can buy the parts to build my bread box because I have 20 customers who want to buy it. To have the arrogance and the audacity, the pompous, over the glasses look at that person and say, no, we would rather keep your money and gamble it at night on currencies back and forth so that we can make a profit for our owner and our shareholder. Well, I guess we have the last laugh because we're going to go to the bank and we're going to withdraw our money. We're going to access our 401k and we're going to sell it, all of it. We're going to take the 10% hit because we don't care. We're going to take the money and we're going to pay all of our debts off, and then we're out of the banking system. Believe it or not, 1 in 12 Americans has already dropped completely out of the banking system. 1 in 12. Can you imagine that? That's almost 10% of all adults in the United States. They're out of the banking system altogether. Don't even have a checking account. Everything is cash. I suggest we take that to about 30%. We'll make the banks cry uncle. Now, interesting things happening out there. We talked about, is it possible to shut the internet down? Well, the conclusion is that it's probably possible to give it a headache or maybe give it constipation, but it's pretty impossible to shut it down. One way or another, if there are people, there's going to be an internet. Now, here's another interesting question for you. Hold on. Let's suppose we go the other way. What happens if all these servers and all these routers, all these networks, what happens if it becomes self-aware? In the world of sci-fi movie geekdom, you remember the movie Terminator. What was that, August of 97 when that came out? One of the most fantastic movies ever written. I mentioned it heavily in the preface of my book, Remembering the Future. I loved it. I thought it was the best time paradox ever. But in the film, the network of U.S. defense computers known as Skynet became self-aware through Cyberdyne Systems. You remember that? And they soon launched an all-out genocidal war against us, against Homo sapiens. Fortunately, the date came and went with no such robo-apocalypse. But the 1990s did bring us the World Wide Web, which is now far larger and more connected than any nation's defense network, believe me. Just ask any 13-year-old that has a smartphone. Could the internet, though, wake up? And if so, what sorts of thoughts would it think? And would it be friendly to humans? Very good questions. And lots of smart people thinking about those questions. Neuroscientist Christoph Koch spelled K-O-C-H, believes we may soon find out, sooner than you think. Indeed, the complexity of the web may have already surpassed that of the human brain. In his book, Consciousness, Confessions of a Romantic Reductionist, published earlier this year, he makes a rough calculation. Take the number of computers on the planet, which of course there's several billion, and multiply by the number of transistors in each machine, well, that's hundreds of millions, and you get about a billion billion, written more elegantly as 10 to the 18th. That's about 1,000 times larger than the number of synapses in the human brain. Well, your human brain. Cook, who taught for more than 25 years at Caltech and is now chief scientist officer at the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle, is known for his work on the neural correlates of consciousness, studying the brain to see what's going on when we have specific conscious experiences. Of course, our brains happen to be soft, wet, gray matter, while the internet is made up of metal chips and wires, but that's no obstacle to consciousness, he says, so long as the level of complexity is great enough. Both researchers working on artificial intelligence would agree that the substrate doesn't matter. That is, it makes no difference what the system is made of. Most philosophers, though not all, would agree. Some say that you gotta have the gray matter to have consciousness. Some, even myself, would say that consciousness doesn't exist in the brain at all. It exists in spite of the brain, that the brain is actually a lens for the consciousness, that there have been humans who have been medically documented to have very little brain. Some only just the lining of the skull is gray matter, and yet they're off the charts with genius. We've also seen people that have been functionally brain dead during surgery or an accident, a near-death experience. The consciousness lives on, learns things, notices things, recalls things. And then when the spirit is united with the body again via, you know, some defib event or coming out of a coma, boom, there's the person again. All conscious with all memories, and guess what? They even know what was going on in the operating room when they were flatlined. But how can that be if the consciousness is just all that wet gray matter? The answer is it is not. Consciousness is superfluous to that. Of course, in a phone interview, Cook noted that the kinds of connections that were wired together to make the internet, its architecture, are very different from the synaptic connections in our brains. But certainly, by any measure, it's a very, very complex system, and it could be conscious. In principle, it could. Of course, there's the tricky question of defining consciousness, as I just said. But for our purposes, it's enough to say that if an entity is conscious, then it feels like something to be that entity. Humans are conscious, at least when we're conscious. Apes and monkeys, perhaps most animals, likely have some degree of consciousness, but I would maintain that they're not conscious, they're conscious. Even dogs can show intelligence. They're just not conscious, they're conscious. They're not self-aware. How consciousness actually works is far less clear. But Cook, going somewhat out on a limb, declares it to be a fundamental property of the universe, akin to energy, mass, and space. That doesn't mean that any physical system is automatically conscious, only that it has the potential to be conscious. It has to have sufficient complexity. It has to be connected in just the right way. The question is, does the internet meet those criteria? The internet is, at the end of the day, not really thoughts. It's just memories. It's just ideas and pictures and sounds and ones and zeros. It isn't really thought. Even today, it might feel like something to be on the internet. Cook says, Each computer feels nothing, of course, but the totality of the internet may be more than the sum of its parts. That's true for my brain, too. One of my nerve cells feels nothing, but together, put together with 100 billion other nerve cells, and suddenly it can feel pain and pleasure and hunger, and it can actually experience, you know, sound. It can experience music, and it can experience this, the scenery around it or another person's face. Would its first instinct of the internet to be kill off those pesky humans, as Skynet was so quick to do? Well, not necessarily. Our own evolution is an ongoing struggle that began some 2 billion years ago, if you start the clock when we were blue and green algae. And this is only if you really believe in the evolution idea. If you believe that we were a wholly designed, not wholly, H-O-L-Y, I mean W-H-O-L-L-Y, wholly designed being, all the proteins in us, then it could be a much shorter time clock. By comparison, the internet of today is more like a newborn baby. It may not have any of the survival instincts that we have as adults. It did not evolve in a world, you know, red in tooth and claw, to use Schopenhauer's famous expression. Should the internet achieve consciousness, it will, at least, you know, at first. It'll be utterly naive to the world. On the other hand, the internet has only existed for a couple of decades, so who knows where it will be 20 years from now. Of course, the science fiction writers have already exploited this territory, not just in shoot-em-ups like Terminator films, but in more cerebral works like Robert J. Sawyer's WWW trilogy. The novels are entitled Wake, Watch, and Wonder. In Wake, the World Wide Web wakes up and, after a bit of learning curve, becomes the smartest entity on the planet. Eerily, as Cook speculated on what the internet might feel, he described a scenario straight out of Sawyer's trilogy, which he had not heard of until I mentioned it. Should there be a large power failure somewhere in the world, Cook said, a conscious internet would experience the equivalent of pain. In Wake, published in 2009, the Chinese government shuts down an enormous swath of the internet in order to cover up a particularly nasty incident that it desperately wants to hide from the rest of the world. The still nascent web mind feels all that cutting and severing, and it doesn't like it. No, not just small changes, not just flickerings, upheaval, a massive disturbance, new sensations, shock, astonishment, disorientation, and fear. The WWW trilogy is a work of fiction, but for Sawyer, it's a plausible picture of what lies ahead in our increasingly wired world. We can't pin down the date when the internet surpasses our brains in complexity, he said, but clearly it is going to happen at some point. Pretty interesting stuff, huh? An aware, awake internet that, you know, we already have smartphones that you can ask questions to, like, you know, how does this work? Or where do I go for that? Or what happens if I eat this or drink a whiskey on beer? You know, all of those questions that it takes some reasoning to figure out. It's going to be able to use patterns and statistical weightings and be able to give us some kind of intelligent answer. And intelligence, after all, is a mark of sentience. Once the internet becomes sentient, what do you think is going to happen? 888-429-5471. When's the last time you had an argument with your car or your truck? You know, there's 5 onboard computers in that vehicle. You get the feeling that your vehicle could think for itself and it's got something else in mind than what you want it to do? I've been there. I'm sure you have. I think it'd be an interesting question if we got at odds with the computer world. Let's go ahead and talk to Robin on line 2. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. You know what I was thinking about? You were talking about consciousness and the internet becoming consciousness. You also brought up the fact that it has memory, right?
Probably. Yeah, it has a better memory than any of us. I forget things I have to look it up on the internet, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. So, but here's what I was thinking. If we're looking at the human beings and it just has memory, that doesn't necessarily include the fact that it has judgment. It would have to judge humans in order to decide whether it wants to keep them or not, right?
Well, unless
so
the
judgment come into play
made for it. You know, sometimes we, as humans, we prejudge people just based on their skin color or their political affinities. We prejudge them. So maybe the internet would just be ultimately prejudice.
So you're saying it's memory of our prejudices would influence and give it judgment?
Well, I think so. It seems reasonable. People have made prejudgments based on one's heritage, whether they're Scottish or Italian or African-American. It would make sense that the internet would be able to make statistical inferences based on the patterns of our thoughts.
Well, I agree with that, but here's where I'm kind of delineating from that. Judgment is what I think consciousness does. It's discerning, and it uses judgment. I think it's a big part of consciousness. But I don't think memory, something that stores memories, would necessarily include judgment. As you know.
Well, it might not. I think I understand the way that you mean judgment, not like, fifth element judgment where she comes here and says, you know, you're such a warlike people, I'm not going to help you, I'm going to let you be destroyed. Not that kind of judgment, but you mean being able to make a judgment based on information that we have. Do I turn left or do I turn right here? Do I want to have the salad or the soup? That kind of judgment.
Right, yeah. And I'm not so sure a computer, no matter how much memory it has, would flip over to being able to start judging things, because I think that's what gives you consciousness, is the fact that you can judge.
I think you have a point there. I think, at least in my personal opinion, it's less judgment and more desire that makes a being, whether it's made of silicon chips or whether it's made of flesh and blood, separate. It makes it sentient. Because if you look at apes, you know, except for their ability to not use tools, they're basically built like us, but they don't have desire. They're just trying to, you know, satisfy whatever urge they have at the moment.
That's a good point. Well, thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate it. It's a good mind-opening experience to think about something that is a whole lot faster, has a whole lot more brain capacity than you or I have, becoming conscious, becoming awake and aware. I think it's an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at people who, let's say, are truly brain damage, like stroke victims, and they have memory, but they don't lose their ability to be able to, you know, make new decisions necessarily. They can even do it based on the memory, but they can make decisions based on that memory. So that's consciousness. But if you have somebody who's kind of like in a vegetative state, and it seems like they don't have any memory.
Yeah, I could see that.
Are they still conscious?
I think they are. But as I said, you know, earlier in the program, they might not be conscious that they're conscious.
So what constitutes consciousness is like is judgment?
Well, that's a great question. It's kind of the Kirk-Spock paradox. And I thought you know, Roddenberry did it so well. You had the logical, physically and mentally more adept Spock, but you had the gut-feeling person that had the ability to balance judgment and do the right thing, whether he was fighting the Klingons or the Romulans or whatever. And he didn't have the brain capacity or the physical capacity that Spock did, but somehow he would make the right decision, even though, as Spock would say, that is illogical.
That's a good point. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Oh, my pleasure. Call back anytime. Well, that's just a very, very interesting question. I'll finish up tonight. We have about 10 minutes left. Speaking of Star Trek, warp drive. You know, warp drive is something that only existed in science fiction. It's the ability to, I guess, focus and redirect power that would make a craft and those inside that craft move at factors of the speed of light. Well, there's a ring-shaped warp drive device that could transport a football-shaped starship to effective speeds faster than light. Now, the concept, believe it or not, was first proposed by a Mexican physicist, Miguel Alcubierre. I mean in real life. I don't mean proposed in a science fiction novel. I mean in real life. A warp drive to achieve faster than light travel in Houston. It may not be as unrealistic as once thought. A warp drive would manipulate space-time itself to move a starship, taking advantage of a loophole in the laws of physics that prevents anything from moving faster than light. A concept for a real-life warp drive was suggested in 1994 by, as I said, Miguel Alcubierre. However, subsequent calculations found that such a device would require prohibitive amounts of energy, like more than you can get out of two Eveready batteries. Now, physicists say that adjustments could be made to the proposed warp drive that would enable it to run on significantly less energy, potentially bringing the idea back from the realm of science fiction into science. Oh, please don't tell me it's lithium crystals. Dilithium. There is hope. Harold Sunny White of NASA's Johnson Space Center said here on September 14th at the 100-year Starship Symposium, a meeting to discuss the challenges of interstellar spaceflight. An Alcubierre warp drive would involve a football-shaped spacecraft attached to a large ring encircling it. This ring, potentially made of exotic matter, very similar to what I actually described in Chapter 2 of The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 1. This is where exotic matter is forms a ring and through intense gravity forms an Einstein-Rosen bridge down the center. The ring, potentially made of exotic matter, would cause space-time to warp around the starship, also through the center, creating a region of contracted space in front of it and expanded space behind it. Meanwhile, the starship itself would stay inside a bubble of flat space-time that wasn't being warped at all. Everything within space is restricted by the speed of light, explains Richard Abusi, president of Icarus Interstellar, a nonprofit group of scientists and engineers devoted to pursuing interstellar spaceflight. But the real cool thing is space-time, that's the fabric of space, is not limited by the speed of light because you're not actually traveling distance, which is what we're talking about when we talk about speed. When we talk about the speed of light, we're talking about 186,000 miles a distance per second. You see, 300,000 meters a distance per second. But in space-time, there's ways to short-circuit the distance. And by doing so, you short-circuit the time. With this concept, a spacecraft would be able to achieve an effective speed of about 10 times the speed of light, all without breaking the cosmic speed limit. The only problem is, previous studies estimated the warp drive would require a minimum amount of energy that about equals the mass energy of the planet Jupiter, which is kind of hard to get it to store. But recently, White calculated what would happen if the shape of the ring encircling the spacecraft was adjusted into more of a rounded donut as opposed to a flat ring, like a toroidal donut. He found, in that case, the warp drive could be powered by a mass of about the size of a spacecraft like Voyager 1 probe NASA launched in 1977. Furthermore, if the intensity of the space warps can be oscillated over time, the energy required is reduced even more. The findings I presented today change it from impractical to plausible and worth further investigation, White told Space.com. The additional energy reduction realized by oscillating the bubble intensity is an interesting conjecture that we will enjoy looking at in the lab. White and his colleagues have begun experimenting with a mini version of the warp drive in their laboratory. Man, wouldn't you like to be in that library, that laboratory? Don't you think that would be neat? I just think it would be fascinating, to say the least. We're trying to see if we can generate a very tiny instance in which this, in a tabletop experiment, to try to perturb space-time by one part in 10 million. They set up what they call the White Jude Warp Field Interferometer at the Johnson Space Center, essentially creating a laser interferometer that instigates microversions of space-time warps. He called the project a humble experiment compared to what would be needed for a real warp drive, but said it represented a promising first step. Wow. And other scientists stress that even outlandish-sounding ideas such as the warp drive need to be considered if humanity is serious about traveling to other stars. If we're ever going to become truly spacefaring civilization, we're going to have to think outside the box a little bit. We're going to have to be a little audacious. And I think that's a much better name. Don't you? Come on. The Audacious Warp Drive. Now there is a very cool name for a warp drive. The uncertainty of science, make sure I'm not getting off my article here. I think we're pretty good. Okay, that's good. It's about 8 minutes till. I just want to let you know that we did find another Earth. Well, not exactly like our Earth. It's a super Earth, and it's close to red dwarf star Jalice 163. It's the top contender for supporting life. Astronomers found it using the European Southern Observatory HARPS telescope. That's the high accuracy radial velocity planet searcher. I just love their acronyms. A newly discovered super Earth at the edge of star's habitable zone could be a top contender for an alien planet beyond ours, which supports life. Jalice 163c, which lies beside a red dwarf star, has a mass of 6.9 times that of Earth and an orbitable period of 26 days. Researchers believe the newfound world location means it could be a super Earth where liquid water could exist. Astronomers found it, Xavier Bonfils of France's Joseph Fourier University in Grenoble told Space.com there are a wide range of structures and compositions that allow Jalice 163c to be a habitable planet. The super Earth orbits a red dwarf star 49 light years away in the Dorado constellation. Well, that's just a hop, skip, and a jump. On their research announcement, the team said that Jalice 163 could have a size between 1.8 to 2.4 Earth radii, deepening if it is composed mostly of rock or water. It received, on average, 40% more light from its parent star than Earth from the Sun, making it slightly hotter. In comparison, Venus receives 90% more light from the Sun than Earth. You know, once upon a time, working for the federal government was considered to be a sacrifice, and it often involved a significant reduction in pay. Millions of Americans felt that serving their country and making a difference more than made up for the reduced wages that they would receive. Unfortunately, those days are long gone. Today, the federal government is the place to go if you want a cushy, high-paying job with tons of benefits. It is incredibly hard to be fired from a federal job. And if you stick around long enough, you'll be guaranteed a huge pension for the rest of your life. The laziness at some federal agencies is absolutely legendary. Some federal buildings are absolute ghost towns at 5:01 p.m. Hordes of federal workers are just putting in their time, collecting their fat paychecks and counting down the days until retirement. And members of Congress are some of the worst offenders when it comes to milking the American people. Yes, members of Congress have fat salaries and enormous pensions, but it is the host of funds and expense accounts that they have access to where the worst abuse takes place. For example, did you know that more than $33,000 was spent in 2010 on the hair care needs of U.S. senators? That comes to more than $300 per senator. The truth is that most members of Congress and most federal employees don't really care that other Americans are absolutely breaking their backs to pay the taxes that fund this system. Most of them enjoy milking the American people, and most of them have absolutely no intention of changing the system that has been so incredibly good to them. There is a reason why median household income is higher in the Washington, D.C. area than anywhere else in the nation. The U.S. government is the goose that just keeps laying golden eggs. Over the past 40 years, there has been an incredible economic boom in the areas of Virginia and Maryland bordering our capital. But it is not because those areas have added value to our economy. Rather, it is because the federal government has been sucking the lifeblood out of the rest of the country and has been showering it upon millions of parasites that are living the high life at our expense. Nobody is saying that we should shut the government down. All societies need government. However, the cold, hard truth is that our bloated federal government has gotten wildly out of control. We desperately need to change course, because our federal government has become a deeply corrupt monster that just keeps getting larger and larger no matter which political party is in control. Very quickly, I want to mention there are 16 facts that show how members of Congress and federal workers are living the high life at your expense. Number one, there are nearly 500,000 federal employees now making at least $100,000 a year. Only 12% of federal workers in 2006 made $100,000 or more. Now approximately 22% of them do. 77,000 federal workers that make more than the governors of their own states. In 2010, the federal government spent, as I said, $33,387 on the hair care needs of U.S. senators. By the way, in 2010, the U.S. senators also pulled $72,370 out of the Senate Restaurant Fund. Senators took $166,000 out of something called the Senate Gift Shop Revolving Fund. In 2010, an average of $4 million of U.S. taxpayer money was spent on personal and office expenses per senator in 1 year. Personal and office expenses. How would you like to have a $4,000 expense account? Did you know that crooks working for the Bureau of Prisons make an average of $66,000 a year? It goes on and on and on. The GSA has more than 12,000 employees. None of them produce anything. Their only job is to list products in a giant catalog for agencies to buy. Only about half of the items are for sale, are made in the United States. We're out of time. I will have to see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Don't go away. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.